This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. We'll start with Forbes. American Dreamers. From Henry Ford to Elon Musk, the innovative men and women who built America have talked to Forbes about their vision and passion for the future for more than a century. Here they are in their own words. Thomas Edison's energy. In 1929, Edison spoke to Forbes magazine about the future of electrical power. While he incorrectly dismissed the idea of electric vehicles and wireless electricity, he was energized by untapped sources of power, including solar, and the 82-year-old wizard of Menlo Park showed no signs of burning out. Quote, "I have done enough to make me 115 years old, working as other men do. And I hope to keep on for 20 years more, which, figuring at the average man's labor per day, would make me 155 years old. Then I may learn to play bridge with the ladies." Close quote. What Thomas J. Watson thinks. He wasn't the founder of IBM, but as its president from 1914 to 1952, Thomas J. Watson Sr. built the computing pioneer into a global tech giant and transformed the way American companies approach sales and customer service. Above all, Watson advocated for ethics in business, as in this interview with Forbes at the start of the Great Depression. Quote, "No one has to be a genius to succeed in business. One does not have to lie awake nights worrying about his job. Men must look their work squarely in the face as if to say, quote, this is the right thing to do, close quote. If we do what common sense dictates, 9 times out of 10, it will be the right thing, close quote." That was from April 1st, 1930. Henry Ford's drive. In May 1927, nearly 20 years after the Model T was introduced, the Ford Motor Company ceased production of the first affordable mass-produced car. Months later, the hyper-competitive Henry Ford rolled out a new model, the Model A, to compete with an ascendant Chevrolet. It was an immediate smash. In January 1928, Ford talked to Forbes about how the groundbreaking car came about. Quote, "We didn't start from Model T and attempt to improve that. We started from scratch. We brushed aside all preconceptions and simply ask ourselves the question, what is a car for? And what does a car have in order to fulfill its purpose? There were 1,000 things, of course, which it had to have. And as we came to each one, we asked, how can this part be made to fulfill its purpose better than it has ever been fulfilled before? More than that, we were looking for the best car that could be made." Close quote. That was from January 1st, 1928. Henry Kaiser's secret weapon. Industrialist Henry Kaiser changed the course of World War II with his ability to mass-produce cargo and military ships. In 1942, as the war waged on, Forbes talked to Kaiser about his indomitable spirit. 3 years later, after the defeat of the Axis powers, he founded another groundbreaking company, a healthcare consortium for his shipyard employees, what eventually became Kaiser Permanente. Quote, "When you're in trouble, do something, even if it may be wrong. If you can't go under, go over. If you can't go through, go around. If you can't go right, go left. If you can't get an angle, take 2 plates and make it. If you can't get a 1/4-inch rod, take 5/16-inch. If you haven't got the right material, go get it. If you can't find it, make substitutions. If you can't substitute, improvise. If you can't improvise, make an innovation. But above all, get the job done." That was from October 15, 1942. Ruth Handler's handle on Barbie. The toy industry isn't all fun and games. In 1966, decades before Barbie became a billion-dollar movie franchise, Mattel's signature doll was in a slump. Co-founded by Elliot Handler 18 years earlier, the toy company had its biggest success in 1959 with the impossibly proportioned doll his wife Ruth had created and named for their daughter Barbara. And yes, she had a real-life brother named Kenneth. She and Forbes discussed the mistakes Mattel had made by building a new plant and then outsourcing the production of Barbie. Quote, We had underestimated the communication and control problems, and we incurred operating expenses that could only have been justified on a plant twice the size. I think we just didn't give of ourselves enough. We trusted in the professionalism of our manufacturers, and we discovered that they simply weren't professional. Their designs were not up to the image of the doll, close quote. That was from June 15, 1966. Sam Walton sells success. In 1977, 15 years after Sam Walton co-founded Walmart, Forbes spent a day with the king of the discounters at a store in Missouri to see how the 59-year-old retail legend inspired his workers. While Walmart's stock had increased more than 700% since the company went public 7 years earlier, Walton remained modest about his own role in that success. Quote, "It's a mistake to think this is a one-man company," close quote, he told the magazine. Quote, "We have a big accumulation of talent," close quote. Quote, "We like to let folks know we're interested in them and that they're vital to us, because they are. Those department heads are the ones who really know what's going on out there in the field, and we've got to get them to tell us," close quote. That was from December 1, 1977. Bill Lear's high-flying success. If it weren't for Bill Lear, there would be no Jet Set, or music on road trips, for that matter. The largely self-taught engineer became a wealthy industrialist with the 1962 founding of Learjet, the first popular private aircraft for business. But Lear had other groundbreaking inventions, including the 8-track audio cartridge and the first car radio, which he later sold to the company that became Motorola. In 1966, he talked to Forbes about why he had had so much success. Quote, "They were wrong. I was right. Even the most optimistic forecasters in 1961 were predicting a maximum of 300 business jets would be sold. I predicted 3,000 through 1975. It's interesting to note that a recent Federal Aviation Agency survey has upped the figure to 4,000, close quote. That was April 1966. Bonding with Michael Milken. In a 1984 cover story, Forbes went under the hood of Michael Milken's money machine. At Drexel Burnham Lambert, Milken transformed the world of finance by pioneering high-yield bonds, what everyone else called junk bonds, and which provided the juice for the leveraged buyouts wave. 2 years later, a Forbes reporter went undercover at a speech Milken was giving to high school students for a rare chance to hear him explain his money-making instincts. Quote, "The scarce resource today is management, knowledge, vision, dealing with change, recognizing what people want and need in the future, and the ability to work together. You won't find those scarce resources listed on a balance sheet. Unfortunately, most people working in financial institutions, credit analysts, don't recognize this. Finance is an art, not yes or no, right or wrong. It is an art form, an understanding of who should be the companies of the future and how to structure transactions. It's an art form that's greatly misunderstood." That was from August 25, 1986. A window into Bill Gates. At 35, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates looked unstoppable. In 1991, MS-DOS was the de facto operating system on most PCs, while Windows 3.0 was gaining momentum. Microsoft Word and Excel were soon to become the dominant software for word processing and spreadsheets. But Gates wasn't satisfied. He was pushing for a monopoly and knew how to get there. Quote, "Believe me, it was not IBM who made MS-DOS the standard. It was up to us to get people to focus their development on it, to get other manufacturers to license it." That was from April of 1991. Robert Johnson's cable capitalism. In 2001, Robert Johnson became America's first black billionaire with the sale of BET, the Black Entertainment Television Network, which he co-founded in 1979 with a $15,000 loan. The Forbes 400 cover star spoke to the magazine about the power of being in 70 million American homes. Quote, "That distribution can be used for anything. It's like having a small boutique on Fifth Avenue. You can always change it, but you're still going to be on Fifth Avenue." That was from October of 2001. George Lucas strikes back. Nearly 20 years after the release of Star Wars, Forbes went to George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch to discuss the digital transformation he had brought to the movie industry with his company Industrial Light and Magic. Lucas's tools gave him greater creative control over projects and allowed generations of filmmakers to blur the lines between fantasy and reality. They also made him a billionaire. Quote, I am very aware as a creative person that those who control the means of production control the creative vision. It's not a matter of going down and saying, you're going to let me have the final cut, because no matter what you do in a contract, they will go around it. Whereas if you own the cameras and you own the film, there's nothing they can do to stop you. That's from March of 1996. Mark Andreessen's Start Over. Had Forbes' 30 Under 30 list existed in the 1990s, Mark Andreessen surely would have been on it. In 1993, he co-created Mosaic, later known as Netscape, the world's first popular web browser, which when he was just 21, and he was already a Silicon Valley veteran at 28, when he spoke with Forbes ASAP, the magazine's technology supplement, about wanting to guide other startups. Years later, as the co-founder of Andreessen Horowitz, the influential venture capital firm he launched in 2009, Andreessen appeared on the cover of Forbes, still looking to change startup culture. Quote, in a startup, you get to do whatever you want. You get a clean sheet of paper and can design whatever you want. Make the world in your own image. But saying that, startups are over-romanticized, like radically. Radically, radically, radically. I always find it to be a roller coaster of euphoria and depression, sort of in equal measures. At Netscape, I'd go home a lot of nights just completely depressed. Like, you know, oh my God, we're going to go right out of business. There's not going to be any market for what we're doing. It's going to flop. Startups are a lot more emotionally tough and demanding than people believe, and therefore not quite as much fun as people think they are. That's from April 2000. The prime of Jeff Bezos. In 1998, Forbes ASAP, the magazine's technology supplement, asked whether Amazon founder Jeff Bezos was, quote, smart or just plain lucky, close quote. After all, his four-year-old book-selling startup had lost $27.6 million the previous year, and the then 34-year-old Bezos wouldn't say when he expected Amazon to make a profit. But he remained unwaveringly optimistic about its future. 20 years later, when he appeared on the cover of Forbes, Bezos was worth nearly $160 billion. That's some luck. Quote, there are lots and lots of other products that will sell well online. In each field, people should ask how they can use the internet to create a value proposition for the customer. If they can figure that out, they will succeed. Lots of firms are already doing it. Companies like Dell and Federal Express are obvious examples. Also remember that the internet is an infant technology. People still run into problems like browsers that crash and call waiting that interrupts their connection. So online sellers right now have to offer an overwhelming value proposition to compensate for that inconvenience. But as technology matures, the value proposition can be less, so it should be easier to sell more kinds of products online. That's from April 1998. Alex Karp's Private Thoughts. As the co-founder of Palantir, the data analytics juggernaut that powers the CIA, NSA, and other three-letter agencies, Alexander Karp has the soul of a philosopher. In 2013, the CEO, with a PhD in social theory, talked to the magazine about what technology like Palantir's means for permanent privacy, particularly his own. Quote, I had $40,000 in the bank and no one knew who I was. I loved it. I loved it. Just loved it. I would walk around, go into skanky places in Berlin all night. I talked to whoever would talk to me, occasionally go home with people as often as I could. I went to places where people were doing things, smoking things. I just loved it. One of the things I find really hard and view as a massive drag is that I'm losing my ability to be completely anonymous. Close quote. That was from September 2013. Jensen Huang changes the game. In 2008, 15 years after Jensen Huang founded NVIDIA, and 15 years before it would become part of the quote-unquote Magnificent Seven, Forbes named NVIDIA Company of the Year. With graphics processing units that were literally video game-changing, the 44-year-old Huang was already looking past gamers to imagine the needs of tomorrow's consumers. Quote, "What if Google Earth had a 3D representation of every single building, every single square meter on Earth, and you could access it in the blink of an eye? Take the Forbidden City in China. I know the model exists. We've seen the model. It is photorealistic. It is cinematic. It is breathtaking. All of those experiences are possible already. The more content there is, the more visual interest there can be, the more processing horsepower people need." That was from January of 2008. Oprah Inc. A small news item in the February 9, 1987 issue of Forbes noted that King World Productions, America's leading television syndicator, had, quote, "another winner, an hour-long talk show hosted by Oprah Winfrey," close quote. By 1995, Oprah's stratospheric success landed her on the Forbes 400, the first black woman to make the list, with a net worth of $340 million, about $720 million today. By 2003, she had become a billionaire and is now worth an estimated $3.2 billion. In 2012, Winfrey spoke at the Forbes Philanthropy Summit about how she turned herself into a brand. Quote, "People refer to me as a brand now, the Oprah brand. I never knew what a brand was when I first started out. I became a brand by making every decision flow from the truth of myself. Every choice I made for every show that was going to be on the air, I made based upon, does this feel right? Does this feel right? Does this feel right?" Close quote. That was from June 26, 2012. Elon Musk's soaring ambition. Having pocketed some $200 million from the sale of his first two internet companies, Zip2 and PayPal, by the time he was 31, Elon Musk talked to Forbes in 2003 about his biggest entrepreneurial dream, building rockets. Having founded SpaceX a year earlier, Musk, a few months away from becoming the primary investor in Tesla, explained why space exploration, particularly colonizing Mars, was vital to the future of humanity. Quote, "Long term, if we are going to go up there and understand what the universe is all about, it will entail leaving the planet Earth. From the perspective of ensuring the survival of humanity, the most powerful thing we could do is establish a second self-sustaining civilization outside of Earth, and the only place that's really feasible is Mars," close quote. That was from May 12, 2003. Zuck to the future. As the billionaire Facebook co-founder approached 40, he spoke with Forbes about the impact of his ubiquitous social network and looked ahead at what AI would mean for the future. Quote, "My own view is that there isn't going to be one central superintelligence. I think that there are going to be lots of different AIs that people interact with for different things and that we interact with throughout our day. And I'm really excited to help make that happen." That was from September 2023. Next up, Road Warriors. Applied Intuition wants to bring its self-driving tech to everything that moves, from big rigs to army tanks. But to expand beyond its $800 million business selling software for autos, it will have to take on Tesla, Google, NVIDIA, and a host of other startups jostling for pole position in the autonomy race. This was written by Ian Martin and Alan Onsman. On a sunny winter day in Silicon Valley, Quasar Yunus slips on his shoes in the entryway to Applied Intuition's headquarters in Sunnyvale, California. The CEO's strict ban on outside footwear in the building means employees and guests must wear slippers, a habit Yunus picked up from a short stint at auto parts maker Bosch in Japan. Feet now clad in black boots, he heads past a 150-foot water tower topped with what looks like a giant can of fruit cocktail, the last visible sign of the site's roots as a Libby's fruit cannery. His destination, the company's garage, a tech warehouse in which you'll find many of Applied's latest experiments in car software. Inside, a dozen or so young engineers who joined from companies like Honda, General Motors, and Daimler line up next to various vehicles. Yunus points to Jeep's 2021 Grand Wagoneer, which is kitted out with its infotainment system, seating controls, and vehicle diagnostics. Further down, there's a robotic Isuzu box truck currently being tested on Japanese highways. Nearby sits a small JCB teleskid loader that can navigate construction sites on its own and an autonomous Ford Raptor pickup put together for the U.S. Army to haul gear without a soldier at the wheel. Despite their differences, all these vehicles share software. Applied Intuition's operating system, which Eunice says can be used in any type of vehicle to connect and manage all its individual electronics and, increasingly, to drive itself. Founded in 2017, Applied sells the system mainly to traditional automakers like Stellantis, the successor company to Fiat and Chrysler, which inked a major deal in October. The pitch? Its tech will help them challenge next-gen players like Tesla, Google, and Rivian, along with an emerging arm of Chinese competitors that are turning cars into computers on wheels. Quote, historically, car makers acquire all these modules from suppliers for the braking system, the seats, and each one has a little software on it, close quote, says Eunice, a fast-talking Pakistani immigrant with a shaved head. Quote, this is why they're not like Tesla. They have to staple together 5 to 8 different operating systems on a single vehicle, and you can't do a single update, close quote. Applied software, he says, quote, is the missing link to make cars and trucks and tanks intelligent, close quote. A one-step tech shop is appealing for car manufacturers that have traditionally struggled with even the most basic software. Volkswagen, for instance, threw billions of dollars and thousands of engineers at an all-out effort to rival Tesla, only for the tech to be scrapped, the CEO to abruptly resign, and the company left scrambling to integrate outsourced code. Even Ford and even reliable Toyota recalled over 2 million vehicles collectively last year to fix software glitches. Applied booked around $800 million in revenue last year, twice as much as in 2024, while continuing to command gross margins of at least 80%. Top-tier investors BlackRock, Andreessen Horowitz, and Kleiner Perkins love that growth and Eunice's vision. He's, quote, the best AI CEO nobody knows, close quote, investor and board member Mark Andreessen recently posted on X. Last June, investors plowed an additional $600 million into the firm. It has raised $1.1 billion in all, pumping its valuation up to $15 billion. That means that Eunice and his co-founder Peter Ludwig, the company's CTO, are worth at least $1.5 billion each, based on Forbes' estimates of their stakes. Applied has been cash flow positive for, quote, basically the whole history of the company, close quote, Eunice says. Not content with making cars work better, Applied now wants to make them work by themselves. It already provides driver assistance as part of its operating system for autos, but Eunice's big bet is a single self-driving platform for everything that rolls, floats, or flies, whether an F-150 pickup or an F-16 fighter jet. Its contracts now span the U.S. military, where it has $60 million in public deals with the Army and Air Force, as well as manufacturers that specialize in trucking, mining, and construction equipment, like Komatsu and Swedish big rig powerhouse Scania. Ludwig claims that fully autonomous self-driving cars are just 18 months away, although a test drive shows Applied's tech is still a bit rough around the edges. Quote, we have invested a huge amount in helping AI see, think, and act. Now we can port that technology to all these different things, close quote, Ludwig says. Quote, whether we're talking about a car, a defense drone, a humanoid robot, are an agriculture machine for farming, close quote. That should help with the price, too. A single, flexible system would cost less than sector-specific ones. Currently, Applied charges for its software on per-vehicle basis. The specifics vary by contract, but a big manufacturer like Stellantis might pay more than $100 per car. Software for industrial vehicles like mining trucks is lower volume but more lucrative per vehicle. Despite its excellent industry traction, Applied faces a range of competitors, including the likes of car software giant QNX. Tesla already has millions of cars on the road with driver-assisted features that Elon Musk is itching to upgrade to full autonomous driving capability. And while Tesla lags Waymo in the robo-taxi race, Musk's tech is far more battle-tested than Applied's. For now, Eunice's only self-driving client is Japan's Isuzu, and some of his long-term customers like VW and Nissan are working with rivals Mobileye and Waymo instead. But even if Applied's software is ready in the next couple years, The combination of regulatory resistance and consumer caution means that self-driving cars on a mass scale are still far off. Instead, Unis is betting that bringing its autonomous software to spaces with more room for error will better position him to be able to win on self-driving cars too. Think mining haulers, farm combines, or drone patrol boats, none of which need to worry too much about hitting pedestrians. It's quote-unquote radical pragmatism, he says. Eunice and Ludwig grew up a few miles apart in the Detroit suburbs, where a nearby General Motors factory loomed large over their lives. Eunice and his family emigrated from a farming village in Punjab, Pakistan, when he was in elementary school, and his father landed a job in another local factory stamping out hoods and fenders. Ludwig's father and grandfather, both GM men, discussed radar-based cruise control at the dinner table. Quote, I probably took apart every electromechanical thing in the household to really understand how it worked, close quote, Ludwig says. The two never met as kids. Eunice took the advice of his uncle, another GM veteran, and studied engineering at the quote-unquote West Point of Automotive, Flint, Michigan's General Motors Institute of Technology, now called Kettering University. He spent half his time learning about business and the rest managing the V6 engine line. After his stint with Bosch Car Parts in Japan, Eunice launched his first startup in 2007, a consumer crowdfunding business called Camisa. It was a bust, but he struck gold with his second, TalkBin, a customer review app used by Crate & Barrel that Google bought just 5 months after it launched. Eunice netted a few million. He then joined the tech giant in April 2011 to work on Google Maps. A month later, he finally met Ludwig, who landed on his team after having studied engineering at the University of Michigan. From Google HQ, the pair had a front-row seat to the future of transportation. Just 6 months earlier, Google had unveiled the project that would become Waymo. Quote, the natural extrapolation was this is going to hit Detroit like a ton of bricks, close quote, Eunice says. Quote, like all good engineers in Silicon Valley, you think, I should go do this myself, close quote. Eunice took his plan to Y Combinator's Paul Graham. Instead of encouragement, he got a reality check. Robotaxis, starting a business and having his first child at the same time? Crazy. Instead, Graham convinced him to join the startup incubator in 2014, becoming chief operating officer with Sam Altman as president. At Y Combinator, Eunice coached future unicorns DoorDash, Flexport, GitLab, and Cruise, the now-defunct self-driving car startup founded by Twitch's Kyle Vogt. When General Motors bought Cruise in 2016, Eunice reached back out to Ludwig, who was still at Google. A significant shift was underway. He argued, quote, the car business is going to be a software business, close quote. Google, Amazon, and almost every car maker in the world were now running self-driving experiments, big and small. To capitalize on that, Eunice and Ludwig decided to build simulation software called, quote-unquote, tooling. It's essentially a video game, like 3D World, that can mimic millions of real-world situations to test autonomous tech's capabilities virtually. They named their new outfit Applied Intuition and quickly landed deals with robotaxi startup Voyage, bought by GM's Cruise in 2021, and self-driving truck company Kodiak, which now trades on the NASDAQ. Quote, tooling isn't sexy, but it's complicated and creates a lot of value right away, close quote, says investor Bilal Zuberi, who led Lux Capital's investment in Applied in 2017. Even today, it's around a third of the company's business, with major customers including GM and Toyota. From there, Eunice landed an early deal to build self-driving software for M1 Abrams tank maker General Dynamics. Now, later generations of the tech are being fitted to cars and trucks, with the operating system connecting everything from the brakes to seats to car computers. It acquired some of these capabilities by buying the intellectual property and associated patents of self-driving companies that went bust after running out of cash, such as autonomous truck developer Embark and OpenAI-backed Ghost Autonomy. Quote, Eunice is an execution machine like no other, close quote, says Mamoun Hamid, managing partner at Kleiner Perkins, who first invested in 2019 and co-led last year's $600 million round. Today, some 1,300 people work at Applied on problems as mundane as Jeep's lane guidance and as futuristic as U.S. Army robot trucks for combat. Eunice doubled down on Applied's military business with a 2025 acquisition of defense tech startup Epicy, which helped make uncrewed F-16 fighter jets for the Air Force and taught hot startup Avex's killer drones to fly in swarms. Applied's tech garage even has a humanoid robot lurking in the corner, though Eunice insists that's not a big priority. Quote, they're the most interesting company in autonomy, close quote, says Grayson Brulta, founder of advisory firm The Road to Autonomy. Quote, the fact that they can go across multiple verticals is huge. If one market goes into a recession, they're not boxed in. On a bright December afternoon at an old gravel quarry in Sunol, California, about 25 miles from Applied's office, a big construction excavator dumps a bucketful of dirt into the bed of a 40-ton yellow Komatsu truck. The truck drives hundreds of feet to a makeshift dump site, unloads, and heads back to the excavator to do it all again, another dozen or so times before the day ends. One day soon, there won't be anyone behind the wheel. For now, there's a safety driver, plus a team of four Applied engineers stationed in a small trailer nearby, glued to high-definition video and sensor feeds that monitor every movement in the simulated LHD cycles, load, haul, and dump. Automated trucks have been used at mining operations for many years in a limited manner, says Joe Forcash, who manages Applied's Automated Industrials Group and previously spent 25 years developing robotic vehicles for Caterpillar. But they aren't perfect. Quote, if anything gets in the way, vehicles don't know how to go around it, close quote, he says. Applied's system promises to be able to pilot its machines around common obstacles such as boulders and Buick-sized potholes. Building autonomous software for industrial trucks like this one is much easier than for vehicles that go on roads where there might be random traffic cones, double-parked cop cars, and texting pedestrians. Still, Isuzu, Japan's commercial vehicle giant, is working with Applied on an autonomous delivery truck you might see heading across town as early as 2027, says Yoshihiro Yasawa, a general manager for Isuzu's automated vehicle program. Initial testing of Applied's system in Japan last fall showed promise and problems. Merging and changing lanes still, quote-unquote, need improvement, he says. Applied's full self-driving tech for cars isn't ready for prime time either, as a short test ride around Sunnyvale demonstrates. There are lags booting up the driving route and mild jitteriness similar to Tesla's buggy, quote, full self-driving system, close quote. Without public testing and scrutiny, there's little outside technical analysis of just how good Applied's platform is. At least for now, Stellantis, the world's fourth largest car maker by volume, is holding off. Next year, Eunice will earn a fee from every new Jeep or Peugeot rolling off Stellantis' production line, but the deal to power the company's quote-unquote cabin intelligence software doesn't include any self-driving tech. Quote, we will keep some autonomy development in-house, close quote, says Stellantis' CTO Ned Kurek. Company cheerleaders may think Applied's all-in, autonomy for everything strategy is a good business hedge, but some critics say it's a scattershot mess. Quote, I think they're in way over their heads, overpromising and chasing every latest shiny object, close quote, says one industry veteran who asked not to be named to speak freely. If it does end up centering the self-driving car race, Applied faces a host of competitors beyond just Tesla and Waymo. Chip giant NVIDIA announced in January that it's building Tesla-like autonomous software, joining a field that includes companies such as Nuro, Mobileye, and Motional. Another tough rival may be London-based Waymo, which similarly is developing all-purpose autonomous driving tech that can be used across a range of vehicles. Quote, our addressable market is every vehicle that moves, close quote, says Waymo CEO Alex Kendall, who has raised $1.3 billion. Applied has lost one deal to Waymo already. Nissan, which uses its simulators to test driver assistance tech, decided to go with Waymo for its autonomy software. Eunice says that Applied's deal with the Japanese carmaker is, quote, probably bigger, close quote. Thanks to its automotive operating system, its simulation business, and a lead in automating, quote, dull, dirty, and dangerous, close quote, industrial vehicles, Applied has spread its bets wide. It's a strategy that worked well in the last self-driving era, during which Applied thrived while many others failed. And there is no reason to suspect it won't work again now, leaving Eunice well-positioned to ride the autonomy wave wherever it goes. Here's a sidebar. First gears. If you think self-driving cars have been promised for years, yet never seem to arrive, you're wrong. They've been promised for centuries. The Renaissance Robot, 1478. In the 15th century, Leonardo da Vinci drew a concept for a cart whose wooden pegs, gears, and coiled springs could be programmed to follow a specific path without a driver. The Italian polymath never built his invention, but a Florence museum finally knocked together a prototype in 2004. It worked, of course. The Ghost Sedan, 1925. In 1925, a boxy Chandler automobile drove down Broadway in Manhattan with no one behind the wheel. It wasn't magic. It was a radio. A former Army engineer had tricked out the vehicle with antennas, and a second car nearby sent signals to control the clutch, brake, and horn. It crashed on its first major outing. The Stanford Cart, 1960 to 1980. Originally a Moon Rover prototype, this golf cart-sized vehicle checked out its surroundings with an onboard camera, a computer, then decided where it should go. But it was a serious sloth, taking 15 minutes to travel a single meter. By the late 1970s, it could autonomously navigate a large room strewn with chairs on Stanford's campus in 5 hours. The Smart Car, 1977. The Tsukuba Mechanical Engineering Lab in Japan built a vehicle that used two large cameras to keep track of white lane markers. Widely considered to be the first real autonomous car because it used machine vision in real time to steer, it could drive at about 20 miles per hour, aided by an elevated rail. The Great Self-Driving Pileup. More than a dozen autonomous tech startups have come and gone over the past two decades. Here are six of the biggest flops, two of which, Embark and Ghost Autonomy, had their IP scooped up by Applied Intuition in bankruptcy. Uber Advanced Technologies Group, founded in 2015, funding $1.7 billion. Backers, Uber, Toyota, Denso, SoftBank, peak valuation $7.3 billion, failed in December 2020. Argo.ai, founded 2016, $3.6 billion. Ford, Volkswagen, $12.4 billion, failed October 2022. Embark, founded 2016, $317 million. Tiger Global, Sequoia Capital, $5.2 billion. Failed May 2023. Too Simple, founded 2015, $1.8 billion. Composite Capital, Sina Weibo, $8.5 billion. Failed December 2023. Ghost Autonomy, founded 2017, $220 million. OpenAI, Khosla Ventures, SoftBank, estimated $300 million. Failed April 2024. Cruise, founded 2013, $18.8 billion. GM, SoftBank, Honda, Microsoft, $30 billion. Failed December 2024. Now turning to Barron's, Boeing stock jumps. It's China again. This is by Al Root. Boeing stock jumped in midday trading after Bloomberg reported that China was close to ordering jets from the American commercial aerospace company. Shares traded as high as $230.88 and were at $227.56, up 2.5% in midday trading, while the S&P 500 and Dow Jones Industrial Average were down 1.1% and 1.2%, respectively, falling amid rising oil prices and a weak U.S. jobs report. This isn't the first time China has moved Boeing stock. Investors have been waiting for a Chinese plane order for a while. In February, President Donald Trump posted on Truth Social about a call with Chinese President Xi. Quote, "It was a long call and a thorough call where many important subjects were discussed," close quote, including aerospace. That led some on Wall Street to speculate on a large jet order for Boeing, something investors have been waiting for since mid-2025, if not longer. Boeing shares outperformed the market by almost 2 percentage points the day of the Trump post. The number cited by Bloomberg was 500. Boeing has more than 6,700 unfilled orders for jets. Boeing didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. China hasn't ordered a 737 since 2019. Its airlines have been relatively quiet in the commercial aircraft acquisition market since COVID. They will have to buy more jets eventually. Boeing estimates that the country will need some 8,800 planes over the next 20 years to meet rising demand for air travel. China accounted for more than 20% of Boeing deliveries from 2010 to 2019, but it is only about 2% of the current backlog of undelivered aircraft. Boeing has some quote-unquote undefined customers in its backlog, and some of those are likely for China. Large orders can always give Boeing's stock a boost, but production remains the main focus for now. Boeing delivered an average of about 400 planes per year between 2019 and 2025, down from about 740 planes per year between 2013 and 2018. COVID and 737 MAX design and production issues are the main reasons. Boeing is expected to deliver about 660 planes in 2026, up from 600 in 2025. By 2028, Wall Street expects deliveries to top 800 jets, a level not seen since 2018. Continuing in Barron's, former Morgan Stanley advisor who bilked NBA clients out of $5 million is found guilty. This is by Kenneth Corbin. A former Morgan Stanley advisor has been found guilty of defrauding three professional basketball players through a life insurance scheme from 2017 through 2020. Prosecutors say that Daryl Cohen bilked NBA players Chandler Parsons, Courtney Lee, and Jrue Holiday out of more than $5 million through the insurance grift and other fraudulent activity. After a five-week trial, a New York City jury found Cohen guilty of one count of wire fraud and one count of investment advisor fraud. Those charges carry maximum prison sentences of 20 years and 5 years, respectively. Lawyers for Cohen didn't immediately respond to requests for comment on the verdict or what they hoped for at sentencing. Judge Vernon Broderick of U.S. District Court in New York's Southern District hasn't set a sentencing date yet. The primary scheme involved viatical settlements, a financial transaction when life insurance policies with a cash value are sold to a third party for a lump sum payment. The buyer takes over the premium payments and collects the entire benefit upon the policyholder's death. Cohen worked with an accountant to induce the three NBA players to purchase viatical statements at substantial markups. The players paid between 222% and 310% of the value of the policies, according to prosecutors. A law firm that Cohen and the accountant, who previously pleaded guilty in the criminal case, used to handle the insurance policy sales, made about $4.5 million from the transactions, money that the defendants used for personal expenses. Cohen spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on home renovations, credit card bills, and a transfer of funds to an individual with whom he was romantically involved, prosecutors say. In addition to the life insurance scheme, Cohen also arranged to transfer $500,000 from Parsons and Lee's accounts to support nonprofit basketball organizations, but then siphoned off $238,000 of that money to build an athletic gym at his home. Quote, Cohen built trust with successful pro athletes, then betrayed it, stealing their money to fund personal luxuries, including a state-of-the-art gym in his own backyard, close quote, says Jay Clayton, U.S. Attorney for New York Southern District. Quote, New Yorkers deserve honest financial advice, not advisors who scheme to steal clients' funds rather than protect their financial interests, close quote. Cohen also worked with a sports agency and another law firm to move more than $328,000 of Parsons money to repay a former professional baseball player described by the Justice Department as a quote-unquote disgruntled client of Cohen's. Cohen entered the wealth management industry in 1997 with Merrill Lynch, moved to Wells Fargo in 2003, and landed at Morgan Stanley in 2015. In March 2021, after looking into allegations that Cohen was engaged in unapproved communication and business with clients, Morgan Stanley fired him. Quote, Mr. Cohen was terminated from Morgan Stanley almost 6 years for outside transactions not disclosed to or approved by Morgan Stanley, and use of an unapproved platform to engage in inappropriate communications with clients, close quote, a Morgan Stanley spokesman says. Quote, we have cooperated fully and have resolved all client claims related to the transactions at issue in this matter, close quote. In December 2021, FINRA, the brokerage's sector's self-regulatory authority, barred Cohen from the industry after he failed to cooperate with an investigation. A civil complaint brought by the Securities and Exchange Commission is pending. Turning now to Fortune magazine, the AI data center boom pits rural America against Silicon Valley billions, by Sharon Goldman. The land around Hassayampa Ranch, 50 miles west of Phoenix, is dotted with saguaro cacti and home to coyotes, jackrabbits, and rattlesnakes. Its few hundred human residents were largely drawn by the tranquility and clear skies for stargazing. But some of the biggest names in tech are suddenly very interested in what happens on this serene stretch of desert. The region once dominated by ranches and farmland, will soon become a new kind of tech hub, one that's largely unpeopled, made up of row upon row of humming, energy, and water-hungry GPU racks in gigantic AI data centers, and there's not much locals can do about it. At a weekday morning hearing in early December, nearly an hour and a half away in downtown Phoenix, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors approved an amendment that would allow for the industrial rezoning of a 2,000-acre property at Hacayampa Ranch. The vote was unanimous, even though hundreds of the ranch's neighbors had signed a petition opposing the project. The developer, Anita Vermalalian, bought this vast tract of desert in May 2025 in a $51 million deal backed by heavyweight tech investors including billionaire venture capitalist, podcast co-host, and Trump mega-donor Chamath Palihapitiya. The plan? A massive AI data center project that will likely draw a major cloud provider or big tech quote-unquote hyperscaler such as Meta, Google, or OpenAI. Quote, we have probably 6 to 8 large hyperscalers that are interested in looking at it. Close quote. Vermalalian told Fortune. In a crisp gray jacket and narrow black slacks with a chartreuse clutch in hand, Vermalalian emerged victorious from the supervisor's auditorium into the mid-morning desert light. She and her team, including her lawyer, real estate agent, PR rep, personal assistant, and sister, grinned in a group photo to mark the moment. For this 43-year-old daughter of Indian immigrants raised in Scottsdale, the vote represented yet another milestone in her family's American success story. Her father, Kuldeep Verma, founded Vermaland, now one of Arizona's major land and real estate companies, back in the mid-1990s, and Vermalalian has built a profile in her own right as a land developer with decades in the business. The Hacayampa Ranch deal, along with another 2,069-acre land parcel in nearby Buckeye, that she sold in August for $136 million, has positioned her as a rising force in Arizona's AI infrastructure race. The crucial December 10th decision on Hacayampa Ranch means that Vermalalian can now submit a detailed zoning application and site plans. The giant data center will feature outsized buildings filled with aisles of GPU racks, round-the-clock cooling systems, and 1.5 gigawatts of power, equivalent to the power needs of over 1 million homes. It will cost some $25 billion to build, Vermalalian and Palihapitiya have said. It's a familiar story across the country. These mega-scale data center projects, providing the computer power underpinning the AI boom and the U.S. race against China to dominate the sector, are changing landscapes, straining energy grids and water stables, and reshaping the economy. And those hyperscalers, including Alphabet, Amazon, and Meta, as well as fast-growing AI companies such as OpenAI and Anthropic, are spending hundreds of billions a year to build out the physical footprint of their AI businesses. Data center equipment and infrastructure spending is on track to rise to $1 trillion a year by 2030. Data center projects are touching off tense fights among developers, environmentalists, and rural residents. And many of those fights end up in places like the Maricopa County Supervisors Auditorium, where locals take turns at the microphone with Silicon Valley-backed developers and local officials accustomed to approving local ordinances and budgeting for municipal departments debate the merits of multi-billion-dollar projects. For much of the past 2 decades, data centers were among the least visible pieces of the tech economy, plain boxy buildings that quietly powered websites, email, and cloud computing, drawing little public notice. The rise of generative AI, though, has changed that. Its enormous appetite for computing power has transformed once modest server farms into sprawling mega complexes spanning millions of square feet, and consuming electricity on the scale of a mid-sized city, along with vast quantities of water. The Trump administration has made winning the AI race with China a central priority, pushing an AI action plan designed to accelerate data center approvals and expand the nation's power grid, even as it has stalled renewable energy development. In an era when AI infrastructure investment accounts for a growing share of U.S. economic growth, both Democrats and Republicans are vying to prove they can get projects built quickly, a priority that aligns with those of deep-pocketed tech and infrastructure investors who have grown and consolidated their political influence as demand for computing power has surged. For example, Pala Haptaya's All In podcast co-host, venture capitalist David Sachs, is now Triumph's, quote, AI and crypto czar, close quote, helping steer federal strategy on AI competitiveness and infrastructure. In 2025, AI data centers emerged as a political flashpoint, fueling heated debates and grassroots campaigns over power, water, land, and jobs. Critics, many from the left, but also including populist Republicans such as Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, warn they are driving up electricity costs and straining scarce water supplies. Meanwhile, supporters, again from both sides of the aisle, argue they can deliver economic growth and long-sought tax revenue to struggling communities. There is Meta's $10 billion, 2,250-acre Hyperion facility underway in northeast Louisiana, where residents have complained about increased traffic and safety risks near schools and homes. There is Dunn County, Wisconsin, where a planned data center near the small city of Menominee has drawn statewide pushback from those opposed to building on prime farmland and concerned about a lack of transparency. And there is Coweta County, a fast-developing suburb southwest of Atlanta, where residents are fighting back against planned data center proposals that could cause utility strain, noise, and light pollution. Verma Lalian's plan is no exception. Her project has already stirred alarm among community members adjacent to the land who fear the impact on the wells that offers their only access to water, as well as how their rural desert lifestyle and property values will be affected by noise, construction, and rising energy costs. It is a microcosm of the quiet but explosive conflict unfolding at the edges of America's AI buildout. As Verma Lalian celebrated with her team outside the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors Auditorium, Kathy and Ron Fletcher, ages 76 and 78 respectively, stood to the side alone. The retirees and grandparents, clad in jeans, moved from California to Arizona in 2020 to live on a one-acre residential plot next to the Hacienda Ranch site, drawn by the beautiful desert views and sunsets. They were not surprised by the ruling, but they were frustrated. In their unincorporated rural community of Tonopah, Kathy Fletcher said, residents have little money, time, or political leverage to mount an effective opposition. District 4 Supervisor Debbie Lesko, a former member of Congress whose district includes Tonopah, declined Fortune's request for comment. Quote, all we can do is plead with the people here, close quote, said Kathy Fletcher, noting that she and Ron were the only residents to drive more than an hour to the Maricopa County meeting on a weekday morning. Quote, we're kind of treated like the redheaded stepchild, and they just think they can throw anything they want out there, close quote, she said. Quote, we're having a difficult time fighting the battle to tell people, quote, you can make a difference, close quote. The Fletcher's next-door neighbor, Cherise Campbell, who owns a hatchery for heritage turkeys, gathered nearly 200 signatures for a change.org petition that focused on the environmental impact of potential light and noise pollution, traffic and infrastructure strain, and the negative impact on property values. Campbell, 38, was born and raised in Maricopa County, spending most of her childhood in Surprise, a northwest Phoenix suburb, quote, back when there were only orange groves and desert and a big ostrich farm, close quote. She spoke virtually at the meeting where she said her free-range birds, which, quote, exercise natural mating, nesting, and young rearing behaviors, close quote, would face hazards with the arrival of big industry. Quote, we don't need or want paved roads or structures surrounded by concrete that will exacerbate the heat island effect of the summer, close quote, she said. Quote, connecting a main road designed for high-volume traffic from the I-10 to this site will present a destructive nightmare for these rural residents and my birds, close quote. And Tanya Pearsall, a 51-year-old mother of five who has lived in Tonopah since 1999 and runs a small dog breeding business, Little Loves Multipoos, said she had spent several weekends going door-to-door to get 100 residents to sign another petition against Verma Lalian's project. Quote, my main concern is water. We are all on wells out here, close quote, she said. Michelle Van Quatham, Verma Lalian's water attorney, said that once the zoning process for the data center is completed, the project will likely partner with Global Water Resources. The public service water provides for the area, or the tenant could supply its own water, which could include digging its own groundwater wells or building on-site water storage or recycling systems. Estimated water usage will be known with more certainty, she said, as site planning and user discussions progress. But she emphasized, quote, water sources will need to comply with Arizona's water laws, including strict groundwater management laws for the Phoenix Active Management Area where the project is located, close quote. Vermalalian said the development will observe setbacks from residences and preserve washes, natural desert channels that are typically dry but carry heavy flows during monsoon rains. She understands that area residents, quote, prefer to see homes or nothing at all so that they're not thrilled with what we're trying to do out here, close quote. But, she said, I think we'll plan it in a very thoughtful way, close quote, with a design that's, quote unquote, aesthetically appealing. Vermalalian's land use attorney, Wendy Riddell, acknowledged that residents often feel a sense of attachment to open land they've long used for hiking, horseback riding, or off-roading, even when that land is privately owned. And she pointed out that Tonopah residents will have the chance to weigh in later in the process during site plan review. AI development has moved at such breakneck speed that despite the billions pouring into new facilities, a central unknown remains, whether the sheer volume of compute now under construction will be needed on the timelines companies are betting on. If demand slows, shifts, or becomes more concentrated, the data center boom could turn into a bust. But after decades in real estate, Vermalalian said she is unfazed by the possibility of a data center downturn. If demand shifts, she said, the sites she has developed could be repurposed for manufacturing, distribution, or other industrial uses. Quote, the trends do keep changing, close quote, she said. Quote, but the way you build these facilities is very similar, close quote. Still, Vermalalian breathed a sigh of relief after the vote. She was aware of the petitions and emails opposing her project, and while she was confident she'd prevail, it was by no means a foregone conclusion. Another AI data center project in Chandler, a bustling suburb southeast of Phoenix, was voted down by city officials this month after massive pushback from residents, even though it was backed by former Arizona Senator Kristen Sinema. After her triumph at the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors hearing and a quick tour of Hassayampa Ranch, Vermalalian headed back to Los Angeles, where a meeting with Netflix and a call with an investor awaited. Back in Tonopah, Kathy Fletcher said she bears Vermalalian no ill will, even as she continues to oppose the project. Quote, I think she's a very successful young lady, close quote, Fletcher said. Quote, I wish her a lot of success. I just don't want a data center in my backyard, close quote. For others in the community, the sense of loss feels personal. Quote, we used to be able to see the Milky Way. That's why we moved out here, close quote, said Tanya Pearsall. Quote, I'm not anti-growth. I'm conservative. I get capitalism. But to allow industrial development on this otherworldly desert, with its vibrant ecosystem of washes and saguaro, quote unquote, it's painful, she said. Quote, I could break down and cry, close quote. Here's a news tidbit. $1 trillion. Is expected annual U.S. data center equipment and infrastructure spending by 2030. Here's a quote. This is from John Sciteri. Quote, I think we're on the cusp of something enormous, and it needs to be treated correctly, close quote. Just as when he was a child at the dawn of the information age, he says, quote, our education and the government have to work together, close quote. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy, and this is brought to you by the good folks of Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.